Hi, and welcome to Lakeshore Update. I'm Dee Dodson. On this edition of the podcast, you'll hear the latest on the sentencing of ex-Portage Clerk Treasurer Chris Didham. A mass shooting at a FedEx facility in Indianapolis was the latest in a recent string of mass shootings across the United States. Federal officials called for a pause on Johnson & Johnson's COVID-19 vaccine. And Chris Nolte has a conversation with Barbara Quant, NFIB Indiana State Director. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Update. Years of effort, putting himself through college and law school, while working his way up through the ranks in Portage to become elected clerk treasurer, came crashing down Monday for Chris Didham as a judge opted to label his offenses a felony rather than a misdemeanor. Porter Superior Court Judge Jeffrey Clymer said Stidham's decision to misuse his position as clerk treasurer in 2015 and 2016 to pay tens of thousands of dollars in city funds to companies registered to his then-girlfriend and current wife, Rachel E. Glass, involved planning designed to minimize his chances of being caught. Stidham, just moments before sentencing, called on the judge to exercise his right to enter the felony conflict of interest charge as a misdemeanor, saying in part, he has a family to support. He apologized to his fellow one-time city officials, some of whom were in attendance during the sentencing hearing, as well as residents of Portage. The Times reports the felony conviction was requested at the start of Monday's hearing by Portage Mayor Sue Lynch, a fellow Democrat, who described how Stidham's failure to properly run the office cost the city hundreds of thousands of dollars in cleanup as well as IRS penalties. And a group of former city officials had voiced concern ahead of the hearing that justice may not be served and had called for Clymer to reject the proposal to allow the felony count to be reduced to a misdemeanor. The plea agreement in the case called for formal probation rather than jail time, and Clymer sentenced Denham to a one-year period. Stidham was also required to pay back over $56,000.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson.
A gunman killed at least eight in Indianapolis Thursday evening at the FedEx Ground Plainfield facility near the airport. Police say the gunman also took his own life. Officer Janae Cook said the shooter was still firing when officers arrived and entered the building.
It is very heartbreaking. And you know, in the Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department, the officers responded. They came in, they went in, and they did their job. And a lot of them are trying to face this because this is a sight that no one should ever have to see.
The FedEx facility involved is near the Indianapolis International Airport, but it is not part of the FedEx hub at the airport. In a statement, FedEx said it was cooperating with authorities.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson.
Merrillville Council members have taken the first step required for the town to receive approximately $7 million under the federal government's American Rescue Plan. The Post Tribune reports the council approved the first reading Tuesday of an ordinance establishing a specific fund in the budget for the federal money. On April 27th, council members, the clerk treasurer, the town manager, and the executive director of Stormwater Utility will meet in a workshop session to create a plan on how to spend that money. Trista Hudson, an associate with financial advisors Cinder & Company, told the council it needed to establish a fund within the budget and have a spending plan in place before it can receive any of the money. She said the first half of the money should come in mid-May, with the second half to be received next year. At a previous meeting, Hudson advised the council to spend the money in four areas: infrastructure, sewer, water, and broadband.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Republicans override another Governor Eric Holcomb veto. A new revenue forecast projects billions more for the new state budget. And the latest anti-abortion measure is set to become law. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports on the week at the Statehouse.
The latest veto override puts into law a measure that allows the General Assembly to call itself into special session during a public emergency, giving legislators more power to intervene in the governor's decisions in times of crisis. It's a reaction to many lawmakers' frustration with Holcomb's executive orders during the COVID-19 pandemic. The governor says the legislation is unconstitutional. An updated forecast of state tax revenues projects Indiana will collect about $2 billion more dollars in the next budget cycle than previously predicted. Lawmakers will take the next week deciding how to spend that money in the new state budget. Legislative leaders say they're focused on their top budget priority, K-12 education, one-time investments, and paying down state debt. And some Indiana physicians say legislation headed to the governor's desk will force them to commit malpractice. It requires them to tell patients about a so-called abortion reversal protocol that leading medical organizations call unproven and unethical. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the Statehouse.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The number of unaccompanied minors entering at the U.S.-Mexico border continues to grow. Many are fleeing dire situations in Mexico and Latin America. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Paolo Marazan reports on one group in Indiana that's helping to find them foster homes.
More than 18,000 unaccompanied minors were taken into custody at the U.S.-Mexico border in March, according to federal data. Some of the children may find foster homes in Indiana. Bethany Christian Services Transitional Foster Care Program provides a temporary home for unaccompanied children who have fled to the U.S. border. Bethany Neal says the group is looking for families who speak other languages, among many other needs.
There is often a need for foster families that can take sibling groups or children with medical needs. We have also seen a need for foster homes for pregnant or parenting teen mothers.
The program in Indiana has fostered more than 80 children since 2019. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Paola Marisan.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Plans to vaccinate Americans against COVID had a big setback Tuesday. Federal officials called for a pause on Johnson & Johnson's vaccine to look into reports that it causes blood clots. And that news reverberated at clinics where the vaccine had already been used. Side Effects Public Media's Farah Yousry reports.
Thank you very much, and nice to meet all of you.
You as well, sir. So you're getting the Johnson & Johnson today.
On normal days, the gym at this Indianapolis school would be filled with kids in PE classes. But on Saturday, it was the scene of a pop-up COVID-19 vaccination clinic.
We just try to stay ahead of, so it's a 0.5 ml small syringe.
And the mood was just as upbeat. One nurse brought her husband to the Kip Indy Legacy High School to get vaccinated, to cheers from everyone around.
And so I thank my husband for being here today.
Thank you for having me, baby. Taking care of me. I appreciate it.
Martindale Brightwood is a predominantly black and low-income neighborhood. It's less than a 10-minute drive from downtown and the site of the recent NCAA basketball championship game. The area has been hit hard by COVID, so a local school, a faith-based group, and a healthcare provider worked together on the clinic. One partner was the Edna Martin Christian Center, which has been in the area for over 80 years. Vice President Angelia Moore says the clinic was designed to help people who found it hard to sign up for a vaccine.
So we went out to homes, we went to stores, we could do it easily on our phone. So we had a team that was, if someone said they didn't know how, we helped them through it. We called and did it for them.
The clinic was also aimed at residents who were reluctant to get a vaccine, like 22-year-old Desta Dowett Ricketts. On Saturday, he rolled up his sleeve for a shot. The clinic used the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, which calls for a single shot and is more convenient for many working people.
The shot was really easy, 1, 2, 3. And I'm just kind of ready to kind of get this thing moving along so that we can kind of have like a better future.
His mood has changed now that the federal government has called for a pause on the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. Health officials said there have been reports of severe blood clots in 6 women aged 18 to 48. He's worried about family members who also got the Johnson & Johnson shot.
I don't really care about myself personally. I really care about maybe my little sister, my mom that got the Johnson & Johnson, especially my mom.
Now Ricketts is having second thoughts about his own shot too.
It is kind of scary, and I do kind of, you know, I will say that I do kind of feel like maybe I shouldn't have got it. I should have just stuck to my gut and not got it, but...
Health experts and community organizations have worked hard to overcome vaccine hesitancy. Now they're worried that problems with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine could set their efforts back. Here's Angelia Moore again from the Edna Martin Christian Center.
If we offer Johnson & Johnson in the near future, would they come out? Probably not as wholeheartedly as they did before.
Community Health Network, which was involved in the Martindale Brightwood event, is getting in touch with its clinics that use the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. It's providing information about trouble signs and symptoms of blood clots. Vice President Don Moore notes the pandemic has pushed healthcare professionals to act quickly with vaccines authorized for emergency use. Still, she says, people should get their shots.
I do not want individuals to use this as a reason not to get vaccinated. We have not found these issues at all with Pfizer and Moderna vaccines.
Still, Dr. Virginia Kane, director of the Marion County Public Health Department, sees the potential for trouble.
I think it could have a major impact. So for those people who are sort of straddling the line, not sure about getting a vaccine, I think it's definitely going to will take a hit.
And she says that could have significant impact for Black Americans, an increase in COVID's death toll. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Farah Yusri.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. This time last year, students had been sent home for spring break as the coronavirus continued to spread, and many never came back to the classroom. At-home learning was a monumental challenge for many, but some families say they've managed to find value in the changes COVID-19 forced onto their lives. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jenny Lindsay spoke to a group of families to hear what they've gained in a year largely defined by loss.
Andrea Maltese remembers the buildup to the pandemic. She just wanted to get it over with.
We're practicing on bringing the iPads home. They had the system set up in school. And I was just sort of thinking, okay, let's call it now. Let's just start shutting down. Get ahead of this, and it'll probably just be a couple weeks and things will return to normal.
Her 2 elementary age kids didn't seem worried. She wasn't either until everything changed.
So I remember we were sitting at the dinner table when all the devices started going off, you know, everybody's phone ringing to say it was just like it usually does on a snow day, but it was that we weren't coming back to school the next day.
In the fall, her kids would continue online learning. They had the resources to do it, and she knew other families might need to send their kids to school. The decision about in-person schooling wasn't clear for everyone. Suzanne Godby Inglesby almost sent her first grader back, but when she got details, she wasn't convinced.
We were waiting on the district to send the information and waiting to hear what this was going to look like, and when we got it, the class sizes were going to be pretty large and they were still going to be going back and forth and using the cafeteria. And I didn't feel super confident about that.
It hasn't been easy. Godby Inglesby says she's not sure they figured out a routine, and it's been a year. But families see more than just challenges. Erica Lee's son doesn't want to go back to school in person, and she sees why. He's used games and technology to customize his work, and his mental health needs have changed. It's been a mixed bag.
He's gotten so much more sleep. he was in therapy for anxiety and was being bullied during recess. And that's all gone away, right? He's had other issues. He's depressed sometimes. He's anxious. He doesn't always want to do what he's supposed to do. And clearly time management issues are going to continue to haunt us. But he has become more independent.
And parents recognize that independence comes with potential benefits. Pam Kakalis likens her son's experience to a sort of trial run for college. She's gained things, too. It's his last year of middle school, and the time they've spent together, she says, has been invaluable.
You know, there was a lot of turmoil going on, so to be able to actually, like, sit and maybe watch some news or look up some news and then talk about it and not feel so frazzled from, you know, being at work or doing something else, just having that sort of time is really been the best thing about this year.
Intense time together during the pandemic means something different for Jessie Wong. Her parents live in China. Her daughters are young, and traveling takes a lot of time. After learning they can work from pretty much anywhere, Wong and her husband are making a significant life change.
We've thought about this for a long time and thought if the vaccines are becoming available and our parents are not getting any younger, and it is really hard for us to visit them or for them to visit us. So we finally made the decision of moving to a coastal city on the West Coast where it will be a lot easier to visit families.
And when it comes to the much talked about return to school buildings, whenever that is, some are more apprehensive than others. The challenges and benefits of a year online are different for everybody, and there's no guaranteed end date to the pandemic. But these families do have one more thing in common. They're ready to get back some of the kinds of experiences they missed out on in 2020 and just let their kids be kids again. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jeannie Lindsay.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Here's regionally speaking host Chris Nolte with a conversation with Barbara Quant.
NFIB Small Business Optimism Index is out, and let's find out what the impact is on Hoosier small businesses. We have with us the director of Indiana's small business operation. We have the director of the NFIB Indiana with us, Barbara Quant. And Barbara, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Thank you, Chris. So good to talk with you again.
Well, looks like the latest index shows some optimism, at least on a national basis. How is it for small businesses in Indiana? But what are still the major concerns as they're all trying to still deal with recovering from the pandemic?
Well, it is good news. It is definitely things are improving. And when we first spoke, when the pandemic hit a year ago, things were pretty darn sad for small business, and it's improved in a great deal. This month, it rose 2.4 points. That's the optimism index. We do this small business economic trends report every month, and we've been doing it for decades. So it's up 2.4 points to 98.2, and as you know, the optimism index cratered in the last year. So this is excellent news.
Fill us in, if you will, on some of the concerns that are still out there. And the report, I guess, the latest report that's out, bears a lot of these out, especially about small businesses that may be open for business, but they're having trouble trying to find people to run them.
Yes, yes. The good news needs to be tempered with an increasingly disturbing trend that we're seeing. 42% of small business owners, and this is a new record number here, 42% reported job openings they could not fill, that they can't find qualified workers. And this is serious. Small business has led us out of every recession. And if they can't find qualified workers to fill the jobs that they are creating, then the economy, not only the small business economy, but the entire national economy could falter.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's right, because they're basically the cornerstone. They're the basis that the bigger companies can help grow on as well. But not to mention all the dozens and hundreds of mom and pop operations, so to speak, in Indiana and other states.
Yes, small businesses create two-thirds at least of the net new jobs. And this is year in and year out. So if they're not able to create those jobs and fill them and grow, then definitely the economy will become stagnant. And right now we need every job we can get.
Are we noticing, too, that small businesses, and particularly those in Indiana, are still having issues trying to not only find the workers to help keep the operations going, but maybe the capital to help build back up here? And I know that a lot of the businesses had to rely on loans from the federal government.
Yes, and the PPP loan program and the EIDL program were both extremely helpful to small businesses, and the majority of small businesses took advantage of those, and that has worked out very well. But there are a lot of businesses that are still, and of course, restaurants and bars come to mind
right.
Very quickly because they were just decimated, and some of them are gone forever. And there are just some businesses that can't grow until the economy gets further along here, and so that or come back. So some are gone forever. There are some that are doing very well, and I'll cite Jason Smith of M&M Car Care in Merrillville as an example.
Right.
We had talked about him a year ago, and he was in desperate shape, and mortgaging his house to help keep his business running, and he was doing everything he could to stay alive and keep his people employed. And now he's doing very well. He's growing. He's adding new people. So it's been his experience is complete opposite of what some folks are feeling.
We know that the lawmakers in Indianapolis are still in session. In fact, you've talked to and had your chance to speak out about some bills that are before committee. What are some of the measures that the NFIB in Indiana is supporting and keeping a very close eye on here in these last days of the General Assembly session?
Well, there have been a number of issues that have already been passed that
right.
were particularly helpful to small business. The first was liability protection from frivolous lawsuits due to COVID-19 allegations. So that passed, and that protects, unless you've been completely paid no attention to protecting people, you can be exempt from being sued on a frivolous basis. Also, there was House Bill 1004, and that it's a small business grant program for those recovering. So this is state money that will help small businesses throughout Indiana. And the one that I was attending this morning is Senate Bill 336, which mm-hmm. is it's business personal property tax small business exemption. It's a mouthful. Small businesses have to pay taxes on all their equipment and their furniture. And so what happens is that very often it costs more to process the actual return than the tax that's raised. So the tax is very small, but you have to go through the process of filing it, and the local governments have to process that. And so it's called de minimis for the reason that it's actually a very ridiculous tax because it doesn't really do any good, and it does harm for all these businesses. So the bill that was originally passed would exempt an additional 52,000 small businesses, and what we're talking about are the smallest of the small businesses, the mom and pops. So it would help all these folks that we've been talking about that have suffered through this last year, the ones that have done so poorly and are now just trying to get back in business.
We know that the federal government has set on the next wave of funding that will help the state of Indiana in particular, and they'll now be up to the lawmakers to be able to decide how it fits into the next two-year state budget. But what does the NFIB in Indiana have to say about the measure that came out of Washington, now in Indiana, and what kind of help that might be able to provide for small businesses?
Well, one place that could very quickly help small businesses and businesses across the state would be to help shore up the unemployment trust fund. What's happened is we've had to borrow from the federal government. You know, it basically has drained all the money that was in there and more. So we need the money to go into that fund so that small businesses don't have to end up paying extra taxes, because taxes will go up. The fund will if it's broke, taxes will have to go up to restore the fund.
Right.
So it would be most helpful to the economy of Indiana to help put money into the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund.
Well, we'll see what comes about in that, and since the lawmakers and the government in general will have a chance to decide what of the funds are going to be able to go into these programs and help in the recovery from the pandemic. And we'll just have to see what happens in this. And that'll be something in the next, certainly the next months and maybe even years here, as the funds are still available to be used. And Barbara, thank you very much for spending time with us to talk about the efforts the lawmakers are dealing with and some of the other information too coming out of the NFIB Small Business Optimism Index. Thank you for being with us today to talk about it.
Regionally Speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday at noon on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the program link. For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure you search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by BenSound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Dee Dotson.